that. They're on their feet again. Richmond, 22 points, and Richmond gets it on.
Junior Bridgman gets up well. He just takes it right over little Robert Smith and takes it downtown.
Welcome to the next episode of What's Next with Eric Wood. Our next guest is Junior Bridgman. If I asked you who was the second richest NBA player of all time, you would likely start off and say Michael Jordan is number one, and who is number two? Maybe Shaq, maybe LeBron at this point, maybe Kobe. You would be surprised to know it's Junior Bridgman, and that's by many publications. And we will talk about what helped him gain this wealth after a 12-year playing career where he was the number 8 overall draft pick out of the University of Louisville. We will talk about playing for Denny Crum. He's also an avid golfer. We will talk about that. He was the president of the NBA Players Association. He was on the PGA of America's board. Junior has so much advice, so much knowledge to share, and he shares it with a number of NBA teams. He's brought in by teams to share this info with their players, and you'll get to hear a lot of that today. Junior is also a very strong Christian man with one of the best reputations of anyone I've ever met in my entire life, and just spending time with him, listening to him, learning from him will do us all a lot of good. Enjoy. Hey, Junior, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so we'll start off talking like we do with most guests. You just start off. We'll just air all of our dirty laundry. You tell me the worst sin you've ever committed, and then we'll go from there. I'm just kidding. Why don't you start off and tell the listeners about where you grew up, sports you played growing up, and kind of how you got to the University of Louisville.
Well, I grew up in Indiana, northern Indiana, small city called East Chicago, Indiana, which is right between Gary, Indiana, and Chicago, Illinois. And steel mill community. Most of the people there worked in the steel mills, and that's why they were there, because they were able to find jobs. And the height of that whole era from a population standpoint was really in the toward my senior year in high school, the early to mid to late 70s, when the population of Chicago got to 28,000 people. So one of booming cities. And once the steel mill started to decline, the population obviously went down. But the main sport in Indiana was basketball. But growing up, I was similar to like any other kid. You tried to play baseball and played football and obviously basketball. And then everything had a season. So
right.
You could play, baseball after basketball season. And then when school started, it was football season. But now everything runs so long that all you can really do is maybe concentrate on one sport. So that's what I did. I tried to play them all up until probably my sophomore year in high school, and then I ran track and played basketball. Those are the two main things. The basketball, obviously being the main sport in Indiana, was the one that everybody focused on.
That's cool. And your high school team, from what I've heard, is one of the best of all time. Four players ended up on your high school basketball team, ended up playing in the Final Four. I'm assuming one of the better teams in the state?
Well, yeah, we were. It's one of those things that happens, I think, once a lifetime. Most of the guys, some of them I played elementary school basketball with, and we played against each other. And just when we got to high school, ninth grade, I should say, we were all on the same team and all played together. But it was a unique kind of training facility or training system, probably a better way to put it, in East Chicago. They taught you from seventh grade on various aspects of the game of basketball in an offense. Like, they would teach you how to make the guard to forward pass in seventh grade, and then they would build on that. So by the time you got to ninth and tenth grade, the offense was accumulation of things you had been doing since seventh grade. So by the time you were really a junior or senior, you were doing things you'd been doing for 4 or 5 years, so the team was better. But we were just one of those teams where certain guys grew and got tall. Certain guys were fast. And we had been playing together so long that we just became a very good team. We were undefeated my senior year, won the state championship in Indiana. But I always tell everybody one of the best statistics that I always say, which is kind of bragging on the team, is in a four 8-minute quarters with – that's all, just 32 minutes.
Right.
We averaged 96 points.
Wow. Was there a shot clock at that time?
There was no shot clock.
Wow. Yet.
So, and we held the opposition to 60 points a game. So, so it was a unique team. We had seven players from my senior year that all got Division I scholarships.
Wow.
So just amazing. And one of those things, like I said, that happens once every, you know, 50, 7,500 years.
Yeah, that's incredible. How did you end up choosing the University of Louisville?
Well, that's a good question. Denny Crum was assistant coach at UCLA at the time. And there was another player on my team by the name of Pete Turkovich, who was obviously our leading scorer, a very good player. And Denny had recruited him when he was at UCLA to come to UCLA. And Pete always wanted to go to UCLA, so it kind of worked out. And then Denny got the job at Louisville. And so Denny had become friends with a freshman high school coach, and he and my family were pretty close. So between the freshman basketball coach and he, his influence, they kind of steered me, helped influence me to come to Louisville. And really that's how I got here, plus the fact that when you looked at the roster for Louisville going into my freshman year, they had eight seniors on the team that would all be graduating by the time I was a sophomore. And at that time, freshmen, we had a freshman team here at Louisville. So it just looked like you'd have the opportunity to play your sophomore year. So with the influence of the freshman coach and everything else, that's how I got to Louisville.
And I believe in 1975, UCLA knocked Louisville out of the tournament. So you end up losing to one of your buddies in the tournament, which couldn't have been fun. But what was it like playing for Denny Crum? I know there's a lot of University of Louisville supporters that listen to the podcast. What was it like playing for Denny?
You know, what I tell everybody, what Coach Crum made you do, two things. One, you know, you came here. I came here from obviously a great high school team, so you thought you were the best thing since sliced bread, you know. And so he quickly dispelled all those thoughts you had about you being great. And the other thing that he made you do was grow up. I remember one of the things he said early on was said, you know, we're only going to play 28, 30 games this year. And if you can't get yourself up to play the best and the hardest you can play every game, if you got to rely upon a coach to get you fired up to play, you'll never be successful in life anyway.
Wow.
And so, and that's what he would do. I mean, his pregame was putting on the board, this is what the other team's going to do. And he'd show it to us. That was the only time we saw maybe what other teams' offense was going to do, because our focus was on what we were going to do on the court. And that's how he approached everything. That's how he approached practice. And really, it was a great segue into what you had to do in life. If you were going to be successful, it was up to you to determine how and what you were going to do to be successful, not relying upon somebody else to make that happen for you.
I love that, and I love your point. If you can't get up for 28 to 30 basketball games, then that's an issue. And I had a coach early in my football career in the NFL. Dick Duron was the same way, Chan Gailey, and that's only 16 games. And you build up all week for one game, and guys would come out flat or underprepared, and that always just boggled my mind how you could do that. And I appreciated the head coach's perspective in saying, it's not my job to give a rah-rah speech. And as I think of some of those Denny Crum teams, the high-flying Daryl Griffiths, and the much excitement they brought to the energy, you would have assumed there was a big rah-rah speech on the front end, as much fun as everyone was having, as much passion. But when you ingrain in the players that's what is expected of you every game, then you don't have to do that. It doesn't
right. –
it's not – okay, now we're playing Kentucky. Now we're going to rise to the occasion. We just play our standard of basketball. I really like that. What's your opinion of the current state of the University of Louisville basketball program now?
Well, I'm as happy as any probably Louisville fan could be with where they are today. I mean, there's no way I think anyone would have thought in Coach Mack's second year that they would be second, first, third, whatever you want to say, in the nation at this point in the year. And even in his second season, you'd have never thought that he would have been able to bring in the talent or get the people, the talent to stay, really just to just have the foundation of a real good team. And even more importantly, I think the foundation for what everybody's accustomed to as far as what Louisville basketball is and was kind of going forward. So, I mean, I can't say enough about how much credit, how great Coach Mack has been for the university, for getting the program back to where it should be. And even more importantly, I think he's done a great job coaching. And and I, you know, I sat behind one game, or I sat behind a team one game, and I really wanted to see, you know, what type of person, what type of coach, and what he did, which impressed me so, was he just coached the kids. He gave them feedback. He told them what they were doing wrong, but it wasn't this, you know, yelling at them and threatening them and all of those kind of things like that. And you could tell that every kid, even when they made a mistake, when they came out, they were eager to hear what they did wrong or what could they do different, and for the next time they got in the game. And it was just a great atmosphere, and I think that's why they're successful now.
Yeah, I echo those sentiments as well. I think he does a great job of coaching those kids hard in an era of college sports where it's hard to coach these kids hard because they're used to getting their butts kissed on the AAU circuit for a long time, and then they come into a program and they're not used to getting coached hard. He does a great job of loving them up, building a trust, have them do his lake house, bring them around his family, swim in the pool. Okay, well, now we've built this trust, this relationship, and now I can coach you the way I want to coach you on game day, and I think it shows, and that's how you turn a program around so fast. And back to your career, you leave the University of Louisville, you're the number 8 draft pick in the NBA draft, drafted by the Lakers, which I didn't know until some prep for the podcast, and then a trade that involved Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. But you go on to have a 12-year career, a great career. What is a piece of advice you can give to somebody in professional sports in general or the NBA for having a long career and sticking with a franchise for as long as you did?
Well, it was two things. One, it was a little bit different era back then, and I was fortunate. When I came to the Milwaukee after the trade, obviously it was a rebuilding year, and I was fortunate, rebuilding period, not just one year. And so they kept the nucleus of the team because they were trying to build a good team. And that was kind of the attitude with a lot of teams back then, was guys get a nucleus and then just add to it. So the same player stayed there more than a year, more than 2 years. Guys, different than it is today, guys weren't looking to go join their friends and have a super team, so to speak.
Right.
If you played for, you know, Chicago, Philadelphia, New York, I mean, that was your team, and you tried to beat everybody else. So it's fortunate that was somewhat of the atmosphere. That's how we were in Milwaukee, and we became good teams. Actually, very good team. We just had the misfortune of always having to beat Philadelphia or Boston in the same year. But it was just, as I said, different and just a great time to be in the league, played with great players, and we're still friends today. And your question, what advice would you give today's players? The first thing I would tell them is, if you're going to try and make this a career, which everybody thinks they can play forever, then you have to approach it that way. You have to physically keep yourself in the best condition that you can, and you have to mentally prepare yourself for your job. Mm-hmm. It is a job, and that means being mentally prepared along with physically prepared for every game, every opponent, knowing what you have to do, what you're going to try to do, and you have to practice your profession. You have to make yourself the best that you can be, and that means just practicing. I'll give you an example. When I came into the league, I was a big guard, so I scored most of my points, you know, around the basket. And I was at a basketball camp with Dick Motta, who at that time was the coach of the Chicago Bulls, and he said, if you're going to be a great shooter in this league, he's telling the kids this, the campers, he said, you need to shoot this basketball 50,000 times in the summertime.
Wow.
And so I'm listening to him, and here I am, after my first year in the league, and I'm saying 50,000 times, wow. And so I went back and
trying to do the math, okay, 50 days in the summer, yeah. You know.
But that's what I did. I took seven spots on the floor, and I had somebody rebound, and we would shoot 10 times at each spot and just go around and around. Sometimes we'd shoot 3-4 hours a day. And I shot 50,000 times that summer and the next summer and made myself into a real good outside shooter.
That's great. I loved what you said about approaching your job and treating it like a job. And my buddies used to crack up when they would come up to Buffalo and I'd say, I have to go to work. And they'd say, that's funny, you call it work. I said, you think we play every day? No, this is my job. This is my craft. I'm doing everything I can to possibly master my craft stay in the league.
Absolutely.
And you mentioned the super teams. What's your opinion on the super teams? I know your team, the Bucks. They have a great nucleus right now, and hopefully they can keep those guys around because they're playing really exciting ball. But what do you think the impact of that is long term for the NBA?
I don't think it's good for the league. I think that you'll end up with, it's starting to go that way, you'll end up with four or five really, really good teams and everybody else.
Right.
And so if I'm a fan, why should I go to see the not-so-good teams play? And that's not really helpful to the league and not helpful for the strength and the longevity of the league. So I don't like it. I don't like three or four buddies that are really good players getting together. But that now they feel that's the only way they can win a championship.
I know it.
And so I don't know how you change that, combat that. But I think in the long run, you might win a championship. But I think overall it's going to have a negative impact on the popularity of the league all around this country.
I agree. And the players nowadays are superstars and guys – fans are more of a fan of a player than a team.
Right.
And that doesn't build the fan bases. That doesn't put rear ends in the arena. And that's what pays the bills and everything else. So, I agree with that completely. Throughout your career, who was the toughest player you ever had to guard? And who was the toughest player ever guarding you?
Whoever was on that night was tough, you know.
Right.
But, at my size and through, when I came into the league, I was everybody had a small forward my size, and I was a big guard. And so, but I played both positions. When I left the league, nobody had a forward my size. They were all bigger, and guard 6'5" was kind of not even a big guard anymore, but the only reason I say that is that when I came into the league, I played against, the Walt Frazier's, the John Havlicek's, the Earl Monroe's. And when I left the league, I had, it was the Michael Jordans and Larry Bird and Dominique Wilkins, Dr. J, all of those guys. So all those names are people that I had to guard.
That's tough.
So to pick one, I can give you the most difficult situation. We're playing Philadelphia. It was either the sixth game or the seventh game in the playoffs, and we are up by one, and last 30, 40 seconds of the game, I'm guarding Julius Erving, and Philadelphia's got the ball. They come down, they give the ball to Doc in the low post, and then everybody clears out. So
it's a lonely feeling.
So it's me and Doc, and I'm thinking, all right, I know he's going to turn into the basket and elevate and do something. And, I'm going to probably have to foul him and go to free throw line. So I'm anticipating all these possibilities. And ironically, he backs in and then he spins to his right and he shoots a fadeaway jump shot. And so I go up to try and distract him and he misses the shot.
He let you off the hook.
He let me off the hook big time. But ironically, they got the offensive rebound and scored, and we still end up losing the game. But that was probably the most difficult situation. But, any night, take Bert, Magic, Doc, Dominique. I can go on down the line, and they could all have 40 points on you in any given night. The toughest – actually, one of the toughest guys ever had to guard was Threat from Philadelphia. Just lost his first name, but and to guard me, Dennis Johnson was tough. That with Seattle, and then he went to Boston. But he was just one of those guys that, you know, you couldn't – he could get through picks. He was quick enough. He could bother your shot. He was just a great defensive player. He gave me the most fits out of anybody.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, what an era of basketball that was. All those names.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. And then, you know, I don't remember the guy who you mentioned would be the toughest one to guard you.
Dennis, what one I was trying to think of from Philadelphia was Andrew Toney. And Boston brought in Dennis Johnson to guard Andrew Toney because nobody could guard him. And if he hadn't hurt his Achilles tendon, I don't think anybody could have guarded him. He was that great of an offensive player. But anyway, I interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, you're fine. But I was going to mention, throughout my career, everyone would say, who's the toughest guy to block? And I'd say, you know, Aaron Donald's really good and J.J. Watt. But I said, you know, there will be a guy in a contract year or whatever it may be. And that guy that year was the toughest player to block in the NFL. And someone would say, who is that? I say, well, now he's with this team and he got paid and he doesn't try as hard anymore. You don't know his name as much. But it's funny how that all worked out. Switching gears a little bit. At one point, you owned 550 restaurants, including Wendy's and Chili's and others. When did you know? Was it during your career that you knew you wanted to transition into the business world, get in the restaurant field, or was it after retirement?
No, it was during. And I tell you how it all came about, collective bargaining. And I was representing her on the player side, and we were at a collective bargaining session with the owners. And, you know, for us, you know, we're all – pumped up, enthusiastic, you got to get more per diem, more this, more that. And you look across the table and the owners are about as disinterested as they could possibly be. And I'm, how could that be? Basketball is the most important thing in the world. How could they not be as excited and as emotional in this whole bargaining process as we are? And so we took a break and we went to our side and they went to their side of the room and I kind of eased over. And now I looked at them and they're all excited and they're all, you know, talking. And I kind of got closer to hear what they're talking about. And they were talking about business and they were talking about, I remember one owner was building a 450 unit apartment complex in Kansas City and wanted the other guys to get involved with him. And true story, one of the other guys was helping promote, produce this film that was coming out. And he said it's going to be a big hit. You guys ought to get involved in it. And the name of that film was The Sting, which, you know, some people, you know, maybe my age will remember. But I just said, what is it about business that has them so excited? And even though basketball is a business, just focusing on basketball was kind of boring to him. And I said, I got to understand, I need to figure out what it is that I'm missing here. And that was the first time that I ever really seriously thought about really getting involved in the business to try and understand what's this enthusiasm, what's this excitement, what is it that has them going. And it wasn't basketball, it was just one of their businesses. But the world of business was what got them going, and that was kind of my initial phase into wanting to get into the business world.
How did you end up settling on the restaurant business?
Well, it was supposed to be that thing that happened or that I did while I figured out what I was going to really do. And I had a banker friend in Chicago that had a couple of clients that were Wendy's franchisees, and he said, well, these guys are going to open another restaurant in Chicago. You're only going to play another year or two. Why don't you think about getting involved with them, and they'll be able to create and make money for you, so when you stop playing, you won't have to just take the first job, because you know, at that time, we didn't make anywhere near what these guys are making today. So you always had that thought in your mind that I'm going to have to do something. So I got involved with these gentlemen, and open up a restaurant, not to go through the whole story, but when I stopped playing, the opportunity came to, because of Wendy's, and they opened up a Wendy's restaurant. That's what I got involved with them with, and so Wendy's said, how about getting involved in Milwaukee? You spent all that time there, and started with five stores in Milwaukee, and 30 years later, we were still in the restaurant business, so, yeah.
That's great. What's your go-to order at Wendy's?
Spicy chicken combo.
All right, I'm glad you said that answer fast enough that I believe it. I know you speak to a number of teams in the NBA, pro sports teams in general, about off-the-court matters, getting into the business world. What are some warnings you give these guys? What's some advice that you give these guys that want to transition into your world or a different area of business?
You know, the first thing is, unless you came up in a family or a background and where they talked about finances and they talked about money and you talked about what money can and can't do and how much this money really is or how much this amount of money really isn't, you really have no real background. I mean, you know, and so the first thing I tell them is to really learn as much, read as much as you can just about the world of finance, the world of money. You know, we didn't, like I said, I didn't grow up, we didn't talk about derivatives around the kitchen table and all these kind of things like that. So you have no idea how much $100,000 is or isn't, or $1 million is or isn't. So first trying to get an understanding of that. And the second thing I tell them is, your business right now is football or basketball or baseball. Focus on that. And focus on, as Don Nelson told me, your job is to be the best player that you can be and to make the most money that you can make. And that's what they should really be focused on, not necessarily looking to invest in this business or to get involved in this or that. There'll be plenty of time for that, but that's a hard thing for a lot of guys, especially when they're making money, to really get comfortable with, because they're seeing other people investing in, whether it's a restaurant or a car wash or something, they think that they should be doing the same thing. But I tell them, you know, your goal is, if you play 10 years and you have an idea how much money you can make in that time, you should be focused on how much can I have in the bank or in an account when I leave this game. And with the amount of money the guys are making today, that should be a substantial amount of money where you don't have to focus on, you don't have to have a business. You ought to be able to live comfortably if you play long enough and do well. But even if you don't and you make half of that money, that still, you are so much farther ahead than 99% of the people in this world that should be your goal. And I said, if you decide you want to get involved in business, then you make that determination. You go learn everything it is about the business you want to get into, not relying upon your cousin or on your mom or your uncle's side to remove to run it for you. You get the knowledge, you make the decision, this is what I'm going to do. And the same effort that it took for you to become the football or basketball or baseball player is the same effort you have to put into the business world if you're going to be successful. And you may have to start off at the bottom, or like I did, cleaning restrooms and all that in the restaurant. But that's what you should do, because a lot of guys think, well, now that I bought it, I should be the executive vice president and not worry about all these things.
Right.
But it's just another way for you to become unsuccessful or to lose your money.
Man, those are phenomenal points. The one that you made about maximizing the money while you're playing, I try to get that through to guys so often, because I see guys worried so much about their transition after ball that they're going to end up playing a couple years less. And I can assure you, looking at the money I make in broadcasting now, it'll be 25 years on my current salary before I match one of my years of salary in the NFL. And I wanted to do something. I'm trying to find fulfillment through another industry. It's not necessarily about the dollars, but people don't necessarily realize that. They see the exception. They see Junior Bridgman and they think, well, I'll just go own that many restaurants. It's so rare. And it's not unattainable, and that could be your goal, but make sure your priorities are straight at this point too. Is there any specific lessons you've learned in business, maybe through a mistake, that you learned a lot from and you grew from?
Yeah, I think all of our learning and all of our growing really comes from mistakes, or I think we learn from failures more than we do success. And it's no different with me. You know, Jim Fitzgerald, who was the owner of the Bucks, I remember sitting down with him at the coffee shop in Oakland. We were playing Golden State that night, and he was saying, if you're going to get involved in business, remember, you're only going to have two problems. And so I leaned forward. This has got to be really good. And he said, people and money. And, you know, all these years later, that's still the truth. The two biggest issues you're going to have are people and money, either lack of or whatever. And if you've never managed people, and we didn't coming up as players, that's one of the first things that you're going to learn, and you're going to make mistakes doing that. And whether you make mistakes on the being too easy side or really being too much on the hard side, you're gonna make mistakes. And the other thing, and I did the same thing, and the other mistakes you made are, you know, when you start to have success, you think that everything you do is going to be successful. Mm-hmm. And so when we were doing well with restaurants, we thought we could just go open as many as we wanted and we'd be successful. I mean, we took over 10 underperforming another concept restaurants in Milwaukee and converted them all to Wendy's, thinking, well, you know, we're successful, we'll make them successful. And within a year, we had closed all 10 of them.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, it's just really, and that was not really putting all of the effort into really understanding what the market was, why those restaurants were not successful prior to our getting involved. So it was, you know, thinking you're going to just be successful because. And so that was another big mistake. And then getting out of what you were good at doing. You know, we were doing well in the restaurant business, so I had a friend that wanted to get involved in the oil products business. So I'm saying, oh, okay, well, you know, that probably will work. That'll make money. So it didn't work. And,
right.
And you didn't know enough about it. You hadn't learned about the business. All the things that I tell guys are mistakes. I did all those things, and year and a half later, you know, that's gone too. So, like I said, made a lot of mistakes along the way, and that's those are the things you learn from.
You make another transition in your career into Coca-Cola bottling. How tough of a transition was that? What was that process like? And is that exciting you now?
Yeah, it's exciting now. And the transition was a little bit easier because that was something that I and one of my oldest son focused on, was getting involved in the Coca-Cola business. And he went and did an internship for a year and a half to really understand the business. And a lot of people say, well, why did you do that, especially if you were, you know, being successful in the restaurant business? We had grown a company this size. Why now transition into something totally different? And the real reason, when I looked at the – and if we're talking about legacy, and when I looked at the restaurant business, you know, I could see some people that were in there maybe second-generation operators, owners of restaurants, but I didn't really see a lot after that. But when I looked at the Coca-Cola business, and, you know, as a restaurant company, we were a big Coca-Cola customer or client. But when I looked at the bottling business, Coca-Cola, there were people who were in there – fourth and fifth generation bottlers. And so I just said, you know, this seems like something that would be able to be passed down from generation to generation. And we were fortunate enough to be awarded or become part of the family. We were the third new bottler in the last 40 years.
Wow.
In the Coca-Cola system. So it doesn't change. People don't, you know, they don't sell, and, you know, it's obviously very difficult to even find somebody that wants to sell one. So we were really, really fortunate and blessed that it happened.
This is going to be a general question, and from knowing you, not the closest one to you ever, but I've been around you enough. You just mentioned leaving a legacy on a financial perspective, but I've never heard one bad word about you. And I know this will be tough for you to talk on and brag on yourself, but what advice would you give to someone that's in the public spotlight to get to that point where you lived in a consistent manner day in and day out, where you left a legacy that you can be proud of and that your kids can always be proud of, that their dad lived in a certain type of way?
Well, I'm sure some people will tell you differently, but, you know, to answer your question, you know, I – I think a lot of it has to do with what do you consider to be important in life. And I think if you get the foundation on what's important, then it's and what you believe then what you believe in is part of that. Then it's not difficult to stay on that path. It's not difficult to vary. You're not going to be pulled in this direction and that direction by whatever way the wind may be blowing. And so, I mean, unlike everybody else, you like to have nice things, but that doesn't mean that you have to have the nicest or you have to have the largest or you have to have the biggest. You have to get that within yourself as to what really satisfies you. What do you think is important? And I tell everybody I've been more fortunate and more blessed than, you know, pick a number. But with that, you also know that none of this is going to last forever. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it goes back to what's the main thing? What's important to you? What are your guidelines? Who are you? And if you don't waver from that, no matter what happens, good or bad, then you look at it and say, it's easy. You're not really doing anything. You know, you don't have to think about it. That's just who you are, who you've been, and who you think you'll be from now until.
That's unbelievable stuff. Thank you for sharing that. You have a great passion for the game of golf, and I've heard, and it's been said about you, you're the most generous man on earth except for on the first tee of a golf course. When did you get into golf, and what's your favorite course you've played? You've played over 90 of the top 100 courses. Let's talk a little golf.
Okay. All right. that's because I'm on the first team, normally playing with some other bandits, so you can't be generous because they're taking advantage of me also. But no.
Exactly.
but golf is fun. It was something that got started maybe toward the end of my basketball playing time, and you started playing because people asked you to play in charity events, and you didn't want to embarrass yourself, so you tried to figure out how you could at least be decent enough to go out there and not get embarrassed. But it just kind of grew from there. I was fortunate enough, I think, at the Pinnacle to be asked to be on the board of the PGA of America, and got to really be around and play with some of played with the best players ever play the game.
Right.
And to really see them play the game of golf, and it just let me know that even though you think you may be getting better, there's no way in this lifetime you'll ever get to that level. And they just play a different game, and it's fun to really watch and to see them, but that was the excitement and the fun of the game is to kind of see it from the inside and kind of go from there.
So you've played golf with Tiger Woods, Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus. I know it can be skewed based upon ages you played with them, but who was the most impressive in person?
That's a tough question. Most impressive, because they all were, were nice people. We had a great time playing, from Tiger to Jack to Arnold to, you know, just kind of keep on going to Phil on down the line, Mickelson. But they were all different, and I think that's what makes the game of golf, is that no two people are the same, yet they're all able to enjoy and play a game that they enjoy doing and at a level that is the best in the world, but they all do it differently. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, that was the fun and the excitement about playing with all of them, was just kind of seeing how different they are, but at the same time, how great they are when it comes to the game of golf.
What's your favorite place or a couple of your favorite courses to play?
Well, if someone said you got two places to play and then your golfing career is over with, I would obviously, number one would be Augusta. You know, that's a tremendous place to play golf. Just the history of it, as many people have played there, and everything that's gone on, it's just neat to walk the grounds there. And probably second for me would be Cypress, you know, out in California. I just think that hole 15, 16, those two par threes are some of the most beautiful golf holes you'll ever play. And it's just a great place also.
How's your golf game at this point?
Oh, I'm struggling. I've had I can give you all these reasons from back surgery to everything else, but I got to get more strokes on the first tee.
Yeah, we all got our excuses. It doesn't matter if it's a back surgery or, you know, young kids or whatever it may be. Speaking of young kids, you traveled a ton through business, through playing. What advice do you have for dads out there, whether you're in sports or business, to maintain healthy relationships at home with young kids and with your wife?
You know, I think it goes back to priorities. And to me, you know, kind of list them up, you know, even though I probably didn't always adhere to them. But, you know, looking back, you know, the first one should have been up for me. My belief was, you know, obviously your faith in God, that was number one. And then secondly, it should have been your family and your kids, because you have a responsibility to help them grow up and get them to a point where they can go off in the world and be on their own. And that should be what you consider one of your most important jobs if job is the right word, or most important things for you to do. And looking back on it, that time that they're young, when you're able to really have an influence, goes by so quickly. You turn around and they're teenagers, and the next thing you turn around and they're going to college, and then they're on their own, they're grown. So I always say that should be your number one priority, you know, followed by, you know, maybe your business or whatever it is, but your family, you know, it's got to be something, and your kids that you just put at that forefront of being important and what I'm not going to vary on.
I love it. Each week we'll do some recurring questions. These are fun to compare guys' answers and whatnot. So we'll start off with, what's your favorite book?
Ooh, my favorite book was, I think it's John Ortman, and I read it every now and then, and it's if you want to walk on water, you got to get out of the boat.
Hmm.
And a lot of times, and it's based on, obviously, the biblical of the disciples being in the water, and Peter the only one having the courage to go out and really, you know, see Jesus and walk on the water. And just how many times, you know, we'll be in the boat, we'll plan to do something or want to do something, but we won't take that step out of the boat to make it happen, the faith to go do something. And so I focus on that. But then the other part, when I'm talking to people, I focus on, I said, well, Peter got out of the boat, but nobody talks about the other 11 disciples that didn't get out of the boat.
Right.
You know? And they talk about Peter having little faith because he started to sink. But how about the other disciples that didn't even have the courage to even get out of the boat? So where do we fit in all of that? I'm just going on and on.
I love it. I love it. That's good stuff. What's your favorite restaurant in Louisville?
Well, it's got to be one of the ones we go to. I mean, we eat at Napa River Grill, but you know, we go out with the Pattersons, who own the Valari restaurant, and then you've got Vincenzo's downtown. So I when you're in the business, you get to know other owners, and so I never like to pick one, because I like all the guys that have that are in this business and like to frequent their restaurants also.
I'm with you. It's funny, when we go up to Buffalo, we end up at the same restaurants where we've become such good friends with the owners, and people say, you don't want to try somewhere else? I say, I do, but I'm only in town so often I feel guilty. They're like family to me now. We got to go see them. What was your first car?
My first car was a 1967 Ford Galaxy 500. I never forget it. The funny part about it, we were getting ready to go on a basketball trip at the University of Louisville, and then it snowed and there was ice, and was coming down the street by the University of Louisville and started sliding on the ice and slid in the back tire of a garbage truck.
Oh.
And it just tore the front end of my car up, got it fixed for $125, but the front end would lean. It leaned the whole rest of my senior year, and the car was blue, but I had a red hood on it, so that was the beginning.
My car in college needed $500 worth of work, and I drove a 92 Honda Accord, and my dad called him and said, "Hey, that sucker's totaled. If you run out of gas, that car's totaled." So he said, "Call them back and ask them what they'll give you for it." So I called them up, and they said, "We'll give you $100 for it." I called my dad. I said, "Should I take $100 for it?" I said, "I'm not going to have a car." He said, "Call them back and see if they'll give you $200." And I called them back. They gave me $200. And luckily, I was dating my wife now at the time. And I would go – if I needed to run errands, I would go drop her off at class, drive her little car around, and then I'd come back and pick her up, drop myself off at the stadium. And I did that for about a year and a half. And I think that was pretty good humility for me. When I got my first car in the NFL, I definitely appreciated it a lot more.
Absolutely.
What was your first job?
Well, how far back do you want to go? Because as little kids, you know, when I say little, I mean, you know, 7, 8 years old, my father worked in a steel mill, but he also would clean a we called it a tavern, but it was a bar, and he washed windows at a men's clothing store. So from 7, 8, 9 years old, we would have to get up with him and go do those things before we went to school. So that was kind of the beginning of really having a job, although we didn't get paid, but that was...
Well, you earned your keep.
Yeah, really. But I think the first real job was... came to Louisville, University of Louisville, and got a job at International Harvester in the summertime. And then we were making parts for trucks, and they'd make the mold, and they'd pour the hot molten steel into the mold, and that was a tough job that did that way back when.
Wow. Yeah, that's not the cushy job that you see some college athletes have nowadays. What is your favorite movie?
Ooh, I'm a comedy guy. I like funny movies. You know, one person that I think is just fantastic, probably didn't get enough credit, is Mel Brooks. And, you know, everything from Young Frankenstein to Blazing Saddles, you know, all those kind of movies like that and comedies, I can watch them over and over again.
That's good stuff. Who's the most famous person in your phone?
Well, I've got Shaq's number. I've got Dr. J's number. Yeah, you got a lot of guys like that.
I would argue that if we could put you up against David Novak, who was two episodes ago, and you guys would probably have two of the more impressive lists around, and some of the athletes that are on beforehand probably would have bet that they would have had the most impressive list.
Well, David probably got some big business names in his, so you know, I don't know. I'd have to he may win the prize. So
yeah, I was instantly impressed when I did David's podcast with him, and afterwards he connected me in an email with Peyton Manning and Tom Brady and said, "Hey, young guy from Louisville just did my podcast with me. I know you guys know who he is," which Tom did because we played against each other so much. I'm not sure if Peyton Manning ever knew who I was, even though we overlapped a little bit in the NFL. And to see their responses absolutely blew me away. And I thought, wow, David is very, very connected.
Yeah.
But Junior, I can't thank you enough for your time today coming on the show.
I've enjoyed it. Definitely.
So much great insight that people, no matter where you're at in life, will be able to pull information from that. And the impact from this will be incredible.
No, thank you. I enjoyed it. Been a great time.
Thank you for listening to What's Next with Eric Wood. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, please rate it 5 stars and subscribe. That goes a long way for us with this podcast. Tune in a couple weeks for another new episode.